Job chapter 33, Elihu week 2. 2 weeks ago, on Sunday evening, we met the young man Elihu. And after laying out the three commonly held views of this individual, I presented to you that I believe that Elihu is not a foreign intrusion into the text of Job, as some think, wrongly think, that Elihu is not an arrogant young man just spouting off a lot of hot air with more hot air to come, though that is, I think, a much healthier view than the former view to have. But I tried to persuade you and tell you that I think Elihu is a good character. So the thumbs up, not the thumbs down. This is Elihu. And that he is, rather than being arrogant or an intrusion, he is a preparatory voice for the greater voice to come. But I also said, remember, that I could be wrong about this, that he really could be a young, arrogant jerk. But I don't think that's the case. But as we continue tonight through chapter 33, I want to begin by saying two things, two general things about Elihu. First, we must be aware that whatever view we take of Elihu, that view will largely determine and temper. That view functions as the lens through which we will see all of his writing and talking. And so, with that in mind, I know it's impossible to remove ourselves of all bias that we have, but part of growing in the knowledge of Scripture is not ridding ourselves of bias, but by becoming aware of the bias that we naturally lean towards, and by being aware of it, thus becoming able to examine that bias to see if it is correct or incorrect. That's what I want you to do. You don't have to see Elihu as a good guy. A lot of people see him as a bad guy. I see him as a good guy. Andrew does not. We've had interesting conversations about these things. Just throw him under the bus right there. That's okay. Many of you probably are in that same camp as well. But once we're aware of our bias, we become able to examine it thoroughly. Now, this is hard to do, but it's a wise thing to do. And by examining our own bias, I think we come closer to what the text is actually saying, rather than pulling out what we want it to say. So whatever view you hold of Elihu, all this to say, let me just say it in a sentence, hold it with an open hand and examine it to see if you're right. Hear the other side, since that's the side I'll be presenting to you. Second, because of these things, as we go through chapter 33 and the rest of Elihu, 34 and on, I will make it an aim, and if I do this poorly, I'll need some of your help in this, but I'm going to try after each section to briefly mention, if you view Elihu positively, this is how you'll interpret these things. If you view him negatively, this is how you're going to interpret things. As much as I can in my own bias, I'll try to do that as we go through this, all with an effort in coming to a proper conclusion about who this young man is. Chapter 33. There are three sections to it. Let's take one at a time. The first, Elihu appeals in verse 1 to 7. Listen to how he begins this chapter. But now hear my speech, O Job, and listen to all my words. Behold, I open my mouth. The tongue in my mouth speaks. My words declare the uprightness of my heart, and my lips know that they speak sincerely. The Spirit of God has made me, and the breath of the Almighty gives me life. Answer me if you can. Set your words in order before me. Take your stand. Behold, I am towards God as you are. I too was pinched off from a piece of clay. Behold, no fear of me need terrify you. My pressure will not be heavy upon you. In these first seven verses of chapter 33, Elihu appeals to Job, giving him reasons, as the other friends did, as to why Job should listen to him. He says that he will open his mouth, that his tongue will speak in the uprightness of his own heart, and Job will find Elihu's words in verse 4, sincere, in verse 5, serious, and in verse 6 and 7, sympathetic. Sincere and sympathetic in verse 4 and 6 and 7, because Elihu's purpose, according to his own words, is just that. He doesn't want to squash Job, but he desires to speak truth lovingly to Job. Job has said in past remarks, particularly chapter 9, verse 34 and 13:21, that God brings him great dread. And it seems that Elihu, being on the skirts of this conversation, heard those remarks, understood them, and reminded Job that in his address to him, such dread need not be present when he is talking to him, because like him, he too is a creature, not the creator. He too is of mankind, being pinched off from a piece of clay. And so Elihu, notice, doesn't want in verse 7 a lot of pressure landing on Job from his own words. But while being sincere and sympathetic, Elihu also says in verse 5 that he has serious words for him too. That Job needs to do some work, needs to set his words in order to make a response to Elihu. Notice, if he can. If he can. So let's pause. If you see Elihu negatively, you will interpret these things as nothing more than the introductory speeches from the three friends that have already come and gone in their conversations. Notice when each of them began talking, they also made an appeal. This is why you should listen to me. God has given me knowledge that you don't have, and I will speak in the uprightness of my heart. And then all that came out was a bunch of hot air. And as it increased, it got hotter and hotter until they were symbolically spewing fire at one another. If you see Elihu positively, you'll want his intentions noticed here. You'll want to show that he doesn't intend to bring trouble or pressure onto Job, but rather his intentions from the beginning in talking to Job are good. And he wants to help Job. He doesn't want pressure to squash him, but he wants to be of use to Job. Either way, negatively or positively, it now is to be seen. Is this going to happen? Or is he just going to be like another one of the friends? Will he really help him? Or will he really just say the same things again and again? So I think we can all agree that that's to be seen. We've heard what he says. Now we'll see if he says it. So in verse 8 to 13, he moves on from his appeal and he starts to summarize. He says this: "Surely you have spoken in my ears, and I have heard the sound of your words. You say, 'I am pure, without transgression. I am clean, and there is no iniquity in me.' Behold, he," meaning God, that's what Job said, "God finds occasions against me, and he counts me as his enemy. He's put my feet in the stocks and watches all my paths. Behold, in this you are not right. I will answer you, for God is greater than man. Why do you contend against him, saying, He will answer none of man's words. So we've come to it. His words. After appealing in verse 1 to 7, Elihu summarizes what he believes Job has said so far in 30 chapters in about 6 verses. This would lead us to believe, also, by the way, that Elihu has been around from the beginning, that he heard what Job had to say, though he's not initially mentioned as being present in the original group. This would imply that he would have been around, if not from the beginning, long enough to get a gist of what Job is saying. According to Elihu, Job has largely made in all his talking 2 points. First, in verse 9, Job has said that he is not guilty before God. Second, in verse 10 and 11, Job has accused God of treating him as his enemy, treating him unfairly, purposefully watching him to attack him, and publicly humiliating him, which is what it means there, put my feet in the stocks. I think if you want to reference a passage where Job said these things, chapter 16, verse 9 and following, I think makes a case that Elihu has read and heard Job correctly, and he has summarized what Job has said correctly. From these two summaries of Job's words, Elihu implies that Job has done what he shouldn't have done, namely, accuse God of being unjust. For saying such things, Elihu says in verse 12, "Behold, in this you are not right." So Elihu will answer Job, reminding Job that no man may contend with God, for he is greater than man, asking Job why he thinks he can contend with God when God doesn't have to answer any of man's words. At this point, one may believe that Elihu has definitively outed himself as little more than what the friends have said before. Just repetition of miserable comfort, thinking that all this is evidence of his youthful arrogance. I don't think that's quite what's in view here. It's important to see the difference here between what Elihu is saying and what the friends have said before. Elihu isn't telling Job that he is suffering because he had sinned, like the friends told him. Remember, all this suffering is happening to you because you clearly sinned. That's what we've heard from the first three friends. No, Elihu is rebuking Job for saying wrong things about God in his suffering. It's different. He's not saying you're suffering because you're sinning. He's saying in your suffering, you're sinning. By speaking wrongly of God, saying that he has unjustly treated you. And these two things between what Elihu's saying and what the friends have said are so massively different, I think that an honest look, we would agree with Elihu that in Job's suffering, Job has said some things about God that were uncalled for, to say the least, out of bounds, to say more, and shocking, to say even more. These things must be addressed. Job must be answered. God himself will address Job soon and leave him speechless. Perhaps because, this is a guess, speculation, informed speculation, I hope. Because Job doesn't answer Elihu once Elihu's done talking, perhaps the reason is because he can't. He said, "Prepare your words and take a stand and answer me if you can." But he doesn't respond to him afterwards, so perhaps an implication is that Job cannot. And so from this, our commentator, Christopher Ashe, who wrote, we've been following him throughout this whole series, he says this is evidence that Elihu's speeches to Job are the forerunner to a rebuke of Job from God that will also leave him speechless. So, you may disagree with that. I think that's what's going on, but we can talk about that afterwards. Third, Elihu instructs in verse 14 to 33. Let's finish out the chapter. Listen to what he says. For God speaks in one way and in two, though man does not perceive it. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls on men while they slumber on their beds, then he opens the ears of men and terrifies them with warnings, that he may turn man aside from his deed and conceal pride from a man. He keeps back his soul from the pit, his life from perishing by the sword. Man is also rebuked with pain on his bed and with continual strife in his bones, so that his life loathes bread and his appetite the choicest food. His flesh is so wasted away that it cannot be seen, and his bones that were not seen stick out. His soul draws near the pit, and his life to those who bring death. If there be for him an angel, a mediator, one of the thousand, to declare to man what is right for him, and he is merciful to him and says, deliver him from going down into the pit, I have found a ransom. Let his flesh become fresh with youth. Let him return to the days of his youthful vigor. Then man prays to God, and he accepts him. He sees his face with a shout of joy, and he restores to man his righteousness. He sings before men and says, I sinned and perverted what was right, and it was not repaid to me. He has redeemed my soul from going down into the pit, and my life shall look upon the light. Behold, God does all these things, twice, three times with a man, to bring his soul back from the pit, that he may be lighted with a light of life. Pay attention, O Job. Listen to me. Be silent. I think this is funny right here. Be silent and I will speak. If you have words, answer me. Be silent, but speak if you can, if you have words. Notice, for I desire to justify you. If not, listen to me, be silent, and I will teach you wisdom. Elihu desires to justify Job. Here, in verse 14 to 33, Elihu makes the case that God does indeed speak, though many men believe he doesn't. Specifically, Job may believe that God doesn't hear him or respond to him about his sufferings. As he said time and time again, why don't you answer me? But God does and has been doing so. And Elihu says that God speaks to man in two different ways. He briefly talks about dreams and visions and the conscience in verse 15 to 18. But then for the majority of the back half of this chapter, he says that God speaks, to use C.S. Lewis's words, with a megaphone to us through our suffering. That's verse 16 to 28. Let's do this in order, though. Through the conscience, in that while men sleep, dream, or slumber, they often have a vision or a dream that brings them terror. Elihu believes that Job ought to pay attention to such things in verse 15 and heed that still small voice of his own conscience in such moments in verse 16. Why? Because according to Elihu in verse 17 and 18, God speaks in these ways to keep us from pride and ultimately save us from destruction. The implication Elihu is making here is that God has been speaking to Job in these ways all along, whether or not Job realizes it. But that Elihu only gives four verses to God speaking through the conscience and gives the entirety of the rest of the chapter to God speaking to man through suffering tells us that that is Elihu's main point in chapter 33. So, how does God speak to man in the midst of suffering? Verse 19 to 22, Elihu describes the suffering man experiences by speaking of things that we all know of. Pain, strife, loathing, wasting away, lack, destruction, and even a closeness or a proximity to death. Elihu says man is rebuked by these things. Not in the sense that man is being punished by God in this suffering, but that in suffering, man is being made aware of God's ways with us, or that in suffering, God truly does intend to teach us much about Him and ourselves, or that suffering jolts us out of our mundane existence and makes us painfully aware, probably not a good pun there, makes us aware in our pain of what is important in life. It is truly a rebuke to man, I think, in that sense. And this is in part what C.S. Lewis was trying to get at in, I believe it's his book, A Grief Observed. He wrote after Joy died, his wife. He said, "Pain insists on being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks in our conscience, but shouts to us in our pain. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world." And we can all, I think, understand this. Without pain, without suffering, life seems to be well. Everything seems to be going swimmingly until suffering comes in its various forms. And when suffering comes, we thought we were at ease, but now we're laid low. On one hand, and yet, because God speaks to us in suffering, lifted high above the clouds to see Him who is above the sun, who gives meaning to all of life. Elihu views suffering in this light and is instructing Job to do the same. To see suffering in verse 23 as a kind of angel or mediator that declares to us what is right and delivers us from the pit in verse 24, that ultimately will lead us to a renewed vigor in verse 25 and new shouts of joy in verse 26. What then is the response to God speaking to us through suffering? It's prayer in verse 27 and 28 that recognizes these things to be true, rejoicing that God does these things in such a manner. Therefore, in verse 29 and 30, Elihu states that what God does with man many times is to bring us back from the pit that we are so naturally prone to go to, and to give us the light of life, to be lighted with the light of life. While the former friends have said Job is suffering because of his sins, or because he's hiding his sins from others, Elihu disagrees and says that Job is wrong to believe that God is silent in his suffering and is no longer speaking to him. But by speaking to him in this way, God intends to save him in the end, delivering him from the pit of destruction. Elihu does say that Job is wrong to speak about God like this, but does mean to encourage him by pointing out that God does speak, and when God speaks, he speaks to save. That's what he's doing with Job. And then as the chapter ends in verse 31 to 33, the initial appeal repeats. He began by saying, "This is why you should listen to me," and he ends by saying, "This is why you should keep listening to me." Telling Job to listen to his words, learn wisdom from them, answer him if he can, or to be silent and listen further if he finds he can't answer. And then we ask the question, why is he talking to him? And then in verse 32, we get the reason. His desire is to justify Job. His desire is to justify Job. This word, justify, in the Hebrew is the word tzadak, which comes from a bigger word that you may, tzaddik, righteousness. It's not holiness, that's kadosh. This is not Isaiah 6, kadosh, kadosh, kadosh. But it's in the same family of holy, righteous. Tzaddik is used many times. Here it's tzaddak, it's another form of it. But this form of word is employed here in verse 32 to give us the impression that Job is being talked to by Elihu because Elihu wants to labor for Job's good. He wants to not only labor for his good, he wants to so labor for Job that Job would be seen as righteous. And that Job would be seen as innocent, that Job would be seen as holy, that Job would be vindicated from listening to his counsel. And Elihu desires to speak to Job to this end. Now, like I said in the beginning, that's my view of Elihu. And this honestly does remain to be seen. Will he continue in 34 and 35 to want to justify Job? Or will he start to tear him down like the other friends did? They all three began, well, maybe Eliphaz began in chapter 4 in a kind and patient way, but the rest of the Bildad and Zophar, as they continued on, it just got worse and worse and worse and worse. The positive view of Elihu believes that Elihu does accomplish this, that at the end of the day, his speech functions to justify Job, to labor for his good. The negative view believes that Elihu does not accomplish this, and that he is just repetition of what we've seen before. We'll see all this play out in the remaining speeches to see if it is true or not. But before we take questions and discuss the chapter, I think it's here, church, that we see Elihu's true desire to labor for Job's good, but it's also here that we see the greater meaning of, I think, Elihu's person and words toward Job. And so by seeing Elihu's desire to justify Job, we gain a view of the greater vindicator and his greater vindication. And so we could say, as a result of his life and teaching, Jesus was nailed to a cross and executed alongside criminals. From a mere human perspective, this would have looked like Jesus' entire ministry was defeated, being an utter failure. But wonder of wonders, he who died did not remain dead. He rose. And 1 Timothy 3:16, talking about this very thing, mentions Jesus being vindicated by the Spirit. This is further fleshed out for us in Romans chapter 1, verse 4, when Paul says Jesus was declared to be the Son of God in power, according to the Spirit of holiness, by his resurrection from the dead, Jesus Christ our Lord. In Christ's resurrection vindication, Christ was in a moment seen to be truly what he was and what he remains to be today. Not a failure or a fool, but God himself in the flesh, triumphant over sin and death. And in this resurrection, he not only rose from the grave, but he led all his elect from all time in him to rise as well, so that they one day will similarly rise from their graves or rise to meet him in the sky upon his return. I think we get a little preview of this in Job 33, when Christ's vindication meant a great deal for those of us who believe in him, just like Job's vindication would mean a great deal to him after Elihu spoke to him.